Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Porter, ready to guide us through, well, quite a stack of new science and some really unexpected insights today.
And I'm Jamie Rufus, here to help make sense of it all and figure out why this stuff actually matters to you.
Today, we are diving deep into Scientific American October 2025. If you're looking for that shortcut to getting up to speed on everything from, say, interstellar travel funding hitting a wall to the surprising complexity of forest ecology, then you've definitely landed in the right spot.
Yeah, our sources today cover a huge range. We've got these really ambitious, maybe slightly crazy space exploration ideas.
Right.
Pervasive climate hazards that are, you know, showing up literally in our backyards.
Yeah.
Fundamental particle physics discoveries and a really important special report on Alzheimer's research.
Our mission, as always, is to pull out the critical pieces for you and show how these sometimes seemingly unrelated fields actually connect.
It's a really fascinating issue, actually. Raises some big questions about how science gets done today. Looking across it, I'd say three big themes really pop out. Okay. First, there's this whole complicated relationship, maybe even a risky one, with private money funding these massive cutting-edge science projects. The editor-in-chief dogs right into that one. You know, can we rely on billionaire patrons for research that might take centuries when their focus might just shift?
That's a huge question. And the second theme.
That's got to be the relentless impact of climate change. It's not just the big headline storms, but these quieter hazards, things like debris flows, landslides, stuff that's changing where we can safely build. And we seem to be, frankly, failing to really calculate that risk properly.
Failing to calculate it. Okay. And the third.
And finally, that special report on Alzheimer's. It's a really detailed look at how the fight is shifting. It's moving beyond just chasing those single anti-amyloid drugs. It's much more about prevention, lifestyle, fixing the care system, and tackling these longstanding equity issues.
Okay, let's kick off with that first theme then, the fragility of private funding. A big dream that, well, turned into something of a cautionary tale. We're talking about Breakthrough Starshot, the voyage to nowhere.
Oh, yeah. Back in, what was it, 2016? This thing launched with incredible fanfare. Mm-hmm. Billionaire Yuri Milner, huge event at One World Observatory, promising to send human technology to another star system. The sheer scale of ambition was wow.
Yeah, backed by a pledge of $100 million just for the proof of concept phase.
The goal was just audacious.
Yeah.
Sending these tiny chip-sized spacecraft nanocraft, basically the weight of a pen cap attached to these things called light sails.
And the idea was to push them with a giant Earth-based laser array, like 100 gigawatts of power hitting these tiny sails.
Exactly. To get them moving at 20% of the speed of light. I mean, think about that. Reaching Alpha Centauri, well, Proxima Centauri specifically, the nearest star system, in about 20 years.
Compared to thousands of years with rockets, you can see why everyone got excited.
And it wasn't just the idea. The people involved gave it instant credibility. You had Stephen Hawking, Maya Jemison, Martin Rees, Freeman Dyson. I mean, these are giants in physics and space exploration. It really legitimized what might have otherwise sounded like, you know, pure sci-fi. Felt like a private sector moonshot.
But fast forward to today, and science journalist Sarah Scholes reports the project has essentially vanished. Quietly disappeared is the phrase she uses. It's officially on indefinite hold.
And this is where that whole funding issue gets really stark, doesn't it?
Wait, so $100 million pledged, one of the biggest science promises in years, and it's just shelved. How much money actually showed up?
Almost none of it, relatively speaking. The article says the total spent across maybe 30 contracts was only around $4.5 million. A tiny fraction.
Wow.
Yeah. Philip Lubin, the researcher key to the whole laser propulsion idea, he apparently got less than $200,000 over 8 years. He even said publicly that Breakthrough funded less than 5% of his total work in that area. It seems like it was a lot of splashy announcement, but very little actual financial follow-through.
That's kind of staggering. Almost like the PR was the main product. But okay, were the technical problems just so massive that the money vanished? Or did the funder just, you know, lose interest?
They identified like 30 huge challenges, but let's talk about the big three.
Okay, yeah. First, the laser engine itself. The photon engine.
Yeah.
You needed this enormous array, maybe city block sized, pumping out 100 gigawatts. And here's the tricky part. Every single light wave from every single laser had to line up perfectly.
Like thousands of voices hitting one perfect note.
Exactly. They managed it on small scales in labs, but scaling that up, huge problem.
Yeah.
And then there's the atmosphere.
Right. The beam has to get through the air without getting scrambled. Turbulence makes starlight twinkle. It would do the same to the laser, right? Spread the energy out.
Precisely. So they needed this incredible real-time atmospheric correction system, making millions of adjustments every second to the beam's shape. The computing power and optical control needed for that. Possibly the single biggest, most expensive technical hurdle.
And the cost of just powering the thing.
Oh yeah, the economics were brutal. For it to make any sense, laser power costs needed to plummet from around $100 a watt down to like 1 to 5 cents a watt, a drop a thousands fold.
Wow. Was that realistic?
Well, it was based on this optimistic idea that laser tech would follow a kind of Moore's law, like computer chips, but, you know, industrial power doesn't always work like that. It was a big gamble.
Okay, hurdle number two, the light sail itself. Tiny, super light, a gram, 4 meters wide, but it had to survive that initial laser blast and, what was it, 40,000 Gs of acceleration?
40,000 times Earth's gravity.
Yeah.
It's an almost impossible combination. It needs to be incredibly light. Almost perfectly reflective and incredibly strong.
What material could even do that?
The best bet was silicon nitride. They actually managed to make it super thin, submicron thickness, like thinner than plastic wrap, but only tiny pieces, millimeters across. They needed meters.
And keeping it stable, facing the laser beam perfectly.
A nightmare. If the beam wobbled even slightly or the sail fluttered, poof, vaporized instantly. So you needed active stabilization systems, which adds weight and complexity to something that has to be almost weightless.
Okay, and the third big one, the elephant in the room, as one researcher called it, communication.
Right. How on Earth, or rather how from Alpha Centauri, do you send a signal back 4.37 light years using instruments the size of a postage stamp?
Especially when Milner apparently wanted 4K video.
Exactly. While the scientists like Pete Worden were saying, look, getting even one bit of information back, like a yes-no for oxygen, would be an unbelievable triumph.
That's a massive gap in expectation. How were they even thinking of solving it?
They had some clever ideas, like using a huge array of small receivers on Earth working together. Or, this really neat one, using our own sun as a kind of passive beacon. The little craft points its tiny transmitter at the sun, and Earth eventually passes through that beam as it orbits.
Still sending data across trillions of miles with something smaller than your phone's camera. Ludicrously hard. So, what's the bigger picture here? The editor-in-chief talks about the perils of relying on the ultra-rich. Government science funding has been cut back for decades, right? Yeah. So researchers increasingly turn to businesses, billionaires.
Yeah, it's been a trend since way before World War II, actually.
Yeah.
And look, it's not always bad. Billionaire science can work. Think about Milner's other project, Breakthrough Listen, scanning for alien signals. That's still going strong.
Right.
Or Paul Allen's Allen Institute, creating those open source brain maps everyone uses. Foundational stuff.
But Starshot is the flip side. The lesson seems to be, when a project depends entirely on one person's vision and wallet, it dies the moment they lose interest or move on.
Exactly. And it forces the scientific community to ask some tough questions. How do you lead research in this environment? How do you figure out when the money is, you know, too good to be true, when it doesn't come with that essential long-term commitment?
Is there any positive legacy from Starshot then?
Well, Zachary Manchester called it a psychological success. It sort of dragged interstellar travel out of pure sci-fi and made it a legitimate thing for serious scientists to think about and work on. It definitely spurred research in lasers, materials, optics, things that are useful even if the ship never flies.
So it pushed the boundaries, even in failure.
It shifted the needle on what seemed possible.
Yeah.
But it also screams for a funding model that's as patient as the science itself needs to be.
Okay, so from grand long-term plans failing in space, let's come back to Earth, where we're also struggling with long-term shifts. We're moving to our own changing planet and a climate hazard that's getting worse. Landslides and debris flows, often triggered by these intense bursts of rain climate change is bringing.
Yeah, and this is a risk that, like you said, often just gets ignored until something catastrophic happens. The article kicked off with this really chilling story about the shingle-kill debris flow. This was in the Catskills, back during Tropical Storm Irene in 2011.
I remember Irene.
It was this incredibly violent surge. Mud, massive boulders just floating along, apparently. Hundreds of trees snapped and twisted, just scoured the landscape bare.
Sounds terrifying, but it went unrecorded. How?
Because it didn't have what the article calls a clear financial fingerprint. Nobody was injured, and the debris flow itself wasn't pinpointed as the sole cause of any property damage. So, officially, it basically didn't happen.
That's worrying. It means the official records are missing potentially huge events.
Exactly. The reality is most slides in New York, for instance, just aren't counted if they don't hit a house or block a major road right away.
It's a huge gap in how we assess risk.
And that risk is going up thanks to climate change. The numbers here are pretty stark.
They really are. In the Northeast U.S., the heaviest rainstorms. They dump about 60% more rain now than they did back in the 1950s. And looking ahead, extreme precipitation is forecast to increase another 52% by the end of the century.
So less gentle soaking rain, more intense downpours.
Which is the perfect trigger for landslides. Globally, geologist David Petley said 2024 was completely off the scale for deadly landslides. He directly linked it to the record-high global temperatures driving these extreme rain events. It's a clear connection.
And we saw awful examples last year. Hurricane Helene in North Carolina. What was it, 20 or 30 inches of rain?
Unbelievable amounts. It triggered over 2,000 slides, including that horrific one in Craytown where 11 people died in one house. Scientists calculate that storm's rainfall was 10% heavier and 70% more likely because of climate change.
And Cyclone Gabrielle in New Zealand. 100,000 slides.
Mind-boggling numbers. It shows the scale of the threat.
So what actually makes a slope fail? The Vermont Geological Survey apparently has a kind of recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. First, obviously, you need steep slopes. Just the basic way the material matters.
Okay.
Second, you need loose stuff, weathered rock, soil, sediment that can get completely soaked with water. Saturated.
Right.
Third, and this is really key, you need a contrast in permeability. Like, a layer of dense clay or solid bedrock underneath the loose stuff. Water hits that barrier, it can't drain through, so it pools up, builds pressure, and basically lubricates the whole layer above it, ready to slide.
Ah, okay. Like putting grease under a rug.
Kind of, yeah. And fourth, you need some kind of instability. Often it's human activity cutting into the base of the slope for a road or piling too much weight on top with construction.
Or losing the trees and plants that hold it together.
Exactly. Wildfires do that in California. In Vermont, they had that crazy period in the 1800s where they cut down almost all the forests to raise sheep, destabilized the slopes for generations.
It's shocking how unprepared our systems seem to be for this growing risk. Landslide mapping, figuring out where the danger zones are.
Yeah.
It's patchy.
Very patchy. And often politically blocked. Get this. Juneau, Alaska, actually rejected official hazard maps. Why? Because homeowners were afraid it would lower their property values.
Wow. Short-term economics over long-term safety.
It happens again and again. Greene County in New York, they updated their hazard plan in 2023 and removed landslides as a significant hazard. Called them unlikely to lead to a disaster.
Despite being one of the most vulnerable counties.
Exactly. It's just willful denial, it seems like. Driven by short-term thinking.
And this creates a real problem for climate adaptation, doesn't it? People are rightly moving out of floodplains in places like Vermont.
Which is good. That's smart adaptation.
But where do they move? Up onto the slopes.
Right into the path of the next predictable hazard. Landslides. It's like solving one problem by creating another.
The article mentions a specific example, a proposed luxury resort in the Catskills.
Yeah, right above that Shinglekill Ravine where the big 2011 slide happened, on steep slopes. And apparently the developers couldn't even show the geologists had properly looked at the risks of cutting down trees and adding all that building weight.
Just pushing ahead, prioritizing development over the known risk.
It seems that way. And a Vermont geologist, Benjamin DeYoung, he warns that this kind of inaction, this political foot dragging, it often only changes after a major, highly visible disaster. He talks about needing an Oso slide of New England, referring to that awful 2014 slide in Washington State that killed 43 people.
We're basically waiting for a tragedy to force us to take it seriously.
Sadly, that often seems to be the case when the short-term economic pressures are so strong.
Okay, let's shift from hazards measured in decades to processes unfolding over millions of years. We're diving into evolution and ecology now. And what's fascinating is how nature handles these long-term challenges. First up, the dawn of bird migration to the poles. #A, the dawn of polar bird migration, evolution feature.
This is such a cool story. It comes from fossils found up in the Prince Creek Formation in Alaska. They date back 73 million years, late Cretaceous. Back then, Alaska wasn't quite where it is now. This spot was way up north, like 80, 85 degrees north latitude, practically the North Pole.
And they found bird fossils. What's the big deal?
It's the earliest evidence we have of birds actually reproducing, nesting, at polar latitudes. And the fossils are amazing. Over 50 tiny bird bones, preserved in 3D, plus dozens of teeth. And many belong to babies, hatchlings. Some bones were only 2 millimeters long.
Wow, so tiny. That proves they were nesting there, not just flying through.
Exactly. And it pinpoints when migration likely became a really powerful evolutionary advantage. Think about earlier birds.
like Archaeopteryx. They had heavy tails, probably weren't great long-distance flyers.
Right.
But these fossils belong to a group called Ornithothoracists, the ancestors of modern birds. They had the advanced flight gear, a deep keel bone for big flight muscles, that specialized tailbone, the Paga style, for steering. They could make the journey.
Why bother going all the way up there?
The Arctic summer. Mm-hmm. Even back then, it meant 24 hours of daylight. That translates to tons of food, insects, plants, and fewer predators sneaking up on nests in the constant light. It was a rich, relatively safe place to raise young if you could get there and back.
But it wasn't just about flying. The article mentions the egg was a key hurdle.
Yes. This is super interesting. So you had two main groups of advanced birds around them, both capable of long flights. The Anantian ornithoines, which were actually dominant back then, and the ornithorhynes, our direct ancestors. Why did our line succeed in the Arctic while the others failed?
Okay, so two groups, similar flight. What was the difference? Why did the Anantian ornithoines struggle up north?
It came down to how they incubated their eggs. The Anantian ornithoines, they buried their eggs vertically in the dirt or sand, often leaving just the top exposed.
Mm.
That meant terrible heat transfer. The parents couldn't really sit on them properly for full contact brooding. Imagine trying to bake something by only heating the very top, it takes forever. And in a short Arctic summer, slow incubation is deadly. The chicks wouldn't hatch and grow fast enough before winter return.
Okay, so the ornithorhynes, our ancestors, figured out a better way.
They evolved key adaptations, like separated pubis bones, allowing them to lay larger eggs relative to their body size. And crucially, they evolved full contact incubation. They could sit right on the eggs.
What allowed that?
Possibly the evolution of something called chalazae. These are like little protein ropes inside the egg that anchor the yolk in the middle. Think of them as an embryo seat belt.
Okay.
With the yolk safely suspended, the parents could probably rotate the egg frequently, ensuring it heated evenly and the embryo didn't stick to the shell. This meant much faster, more efficient development. Chicks could hatch and fledge quickly, beating that Arctic clock.
Wow. Little details matter. Was there anything else holding the other group back?
Yeah, the Anantian ornithines also had this really risky molting pattern. They apparently lost all their flight feathers at once. Imagine being flightless during a sudden cold snap in the Arctic. Lethal.
So, connecting this ancient history to now.
Right. The paleobiologist Lauren Wilson makes this point. Birds have been successfully nesting in this region for 73 million years through huge climate shifts. And now, human-caused warming is threatening that incredibly long, stable pattern and, you know, the geological blink of an eye. These ancient successful strategies are suddenly failing. #B, the lives of dead trees, ecology feature.
Okay, let's switch from rapid evolution over millennia to something incredibly slow, the process of decay. This brings us back to that need for long-term focus. We're talking about a 40-year log decomposition project in Oregon, led by an ecologist nicknamed Dr. Death.
That's Mark Harmon. And yeah, Dr. Death, because he studies dead things. His project is actually designed to run for 200 years. Can you imagine?
Two centuries. What's the goal?
To establish a really solid long-term baseline for how logs decompose. Because it's not instant, right? A log might lie on the forest floor for anywhere from just 3 years to maybe 750 years.
Wow, 750 years.
Yeah, it varies massively, like 244-fold globally, depending on the tree species and the climate. Harmon started by comparing the big four trees in his Oregon forest: Douglas fir, western hemlock, western red cedar, and Pacific silver fir.
And even parts of the same tree rot differently, right?
Exactly. Like western red cedar, the outer sapwood goes pretty fast, but the inner heartwood, super decay resistant. That's why we use it for things like decks and fences.
Yeah.
It lasts.
So, okay, they measured decay rates. What else did they find over 40 years?
Some really profound stuff about how dead trees actually shape the forest. They're not just lying there. Harmon found they act like massive ecosystem engineers. They totally change the structure of the forest floor.
How does a dead log do that?
It's cool. Underneath the log, fungi are busy digesting the organic soil, basically eating it away so the ground level drops, creating a depression. But on top of the log, leaves, needles, and twigs pile up and decompose, creating brand new, fertile organic soil.
So the log lifts the forest floor up.
Effectively, yeah. By up to 50 centimeters, almost 2 feet, off the original ground level. It changes the soil chemistry, nutrient flow, microbial life, creating these little microhabitats essential for new seedlings.
And this long, slow decay is crucial for carbon, right? Especially for climate models.
Hugely important. Those slow-rotting trees, like old-growth cedar, they lock up carbon for centuries. They're a vital carbon sink.
What's the concern there?
The worry is about different types of fungi.
There's brown rot, which mostly eats cellulose, and white rot, which can break down the tougher lignin and release more CO2. As forests warm, especially northern ones, there's a fear that white rot fungi might become more dominant.
And that would speed up carbon release from all that deadwood.
Exactly. Where climate models might assume that carbon is locked away for a long time, warming could accelerate its release back into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's a potentially big feedback loop.
You know, this really highlights the challenge of doing long-term science. Harmon started this knowing he wouldn't see the end. He was apparently told it was the most stupid fucking thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, and then he'd die before it finished. It takes incredible dedication, doesn't it, to commit to something that relies on future generations to complete.
And then nature threw a massive wrench in the works. A wildfire.
Yeah, the Lookout Fire in August 2023 burned 70% of the watershed where the study sites were. Incinerated 3 of the 6 main log sites.
Oh, no. Decades of data.
Tragic for the original baseline, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it also created this unexpected real-world experiment.
A grim silver lining, I guess.
Sort of. Now they have a chance to study right from the start how fire completely changes the decomposition process. How does ash and charcoal affect decay? How do new trees colonize burned logs? It forces the science to adapt, to keep measuring change across generations, even after a catastrophe. It embodies that long-term focus, really.
Okay, let's shift gears into our advances section. Shorter bursts of insight from across the scientific map. We'll take our time with each one, though. First up, physics and a step closer to understanding why we exist.
Yeah, this is from CERN's LHCb experiment. They've observed something called CP violation, basically. Matter and antimatter behaving slightly differently in a new type of particle.
Yeah.
Baryons containing booty quarks.
Okay, CP violation.
Yeah.
That's the asymmetry needed for matter to win out over antimatter after the Big Bang, right? So more matter was left over.
Exactly. And finding it here, specifically with booty quarks and baryons, is a new milestone. It confirms a prediction of the standard model of particle physics, which is, you know, our best current theory of fundamental particles and forces.
But wait, if it fits the standard model, does it solve the big mystery? Because the difference they measured, it's tiny, isn't it? Not nearly enough to explain why the universe is all matter and basically no antimatter.
Correct. It doesn't solve the big cosmic puzzle on its own. But what it does do is tell physicists they're looking in the right places, but that the standard model, while accurate, must be incomplete.
Ah, so the real answer must lie in physics beyond the standard model.
Precisely. There must be other, maybe heavier, undiscovered particles or forces that created a much bigger imbalance way back in the early universe. This result confirms the standard model works for what it describes, but points strongly towards needing something new, those cracks in the standard model, to get the full picture.
Okay. Moving from the very small to the very large space, astronomers found a planet apparently triggering huge flares on its own star, like self-destruction.
Sort of. It's the first confirmed case. A gas giant, HIP-67522b, orbits super close to its star. As it whips around, it plows through the star's powerful magnetic field lines.
And that causes flares.
Yeah, it seems to perturb the magnetic field, acting like the last push needed to trigger these massive eruptions of energy from the star's surface, like poking a coiled magnetic spring.
What does that do to the planet itself?
It gets blasted. 6 times more flares and radiation than it would otherwise. This intense bombardment is stripping away its atmosphere at a huge rate.
So it's shrinking?
Dramatically. Yeah. They estimate it will go from Jupiter size down to Neptune size in about 100 million years. It's basically getting eroded away by its star's fury, which it helped trigger.
Could we use that flaring pattern, to find other planets?
That's the really interesting possibility. If you see a star flaring in a specific repeating pattern that matches an orbital period, maybe you can infer a planet is there, interacting with its magnetic field. Even if you can't see the planet directly using other methods like transit, it could be a whole new detection technique.
Cool. Okay, back down to Earth. Dolphin echolocation. We usually think of it as seeing with sound, but new research suggests it's processed more like touch.
Yeah, this is fascinating brain mapping stuff. The key is a neural pathway they found. It connects the part of the brain that initially processes sound, the inferior colliculus, directly to the cerebellum.
And the cerebellum is usually associated with
motor control, balance, coordinating movement, making rapid calculations about body position. It's very similar to how our brains process tactile information from our skin when we're exploring something with our hands.
So less like passively taking in a picture, more like actively feeling things out.
Exactly. The article uses a great metaphor. It's like you drop your keys in the dark and you're groping around for them. Your visual field is wide, panoramic. But a dolphin's sonar beam is narrow, focused. They have to actively scan, move their head and body, and build up a 3D picture piece by piece, constantly relating the returning echoes to their own movements. It's an active, touch-like exploration using sound waves.
Huh. Okay, next. Technology and how it might be messing with our heads. Search bias and echo chambers.
Yeah, a study looked at how people search online, even using AI tools like ChatGPT or Bing, and they found that a significant chunk of people, between 9% and 34%, use really narrow search terms.
Like what?
Like if you already think caffeine is bad, you search specifically for caffeine negative effects instead of just caffeine effects. You're priming the search to confirm what you already believe, yeah. Often without even realizing it.
And the algorithms, designed to give us relevant results, they just feed that bias.
Pretty much. They're optimized to give you what matches your query, which, if your query is biased, reinforces your existing view. It contributes to polarization.
Is there a fix?
Actually, yes, and it seems pretty simple. When they changed the algorithms in the study to deliberately provide broader results or results showing alternative viewpoints, it significantly reduced the bias. And importantly, users rated these broader results as just as useful.
So the answer could be as simple as a search broadly button.
Potentially, yeah. Or just algorithms designed to offer a wider perspective by default. It suggests the tech itself can be adjusted to mitigate the problem it helps create.
Interesting. Okay. Medical news, male contraception. Sounds like there are real breakthroughs happening.
Definitely progress on a couple of fronts. There's a non-hormonal pill, YCT-529. It just finished phase one trials. Showed it gets into the system quickly and effectively, which suggests once daily use could work. And crucially, so far, no major side effects reported. That's always been the big hurdle for male options.
And there's a hormonal gel, too.
Yes, Nest. That one uses hormones delivered through the skin. It's further along completed phase two, and a big phase three trial is planned. So it's on a clearer path to potential approval.
What's driving this push now?
Huge interest, apparently. The article mentions surveys showing up to 75% of men are willing to try new contraceptives. There seems to be a real desire for more shared responsibility and reproductive agency. Science is finally catching up to that social shift.
Good to hear. Lastly, something completely different. Math. Unruly knots. Someone proved a really old idea wrong.
Yeah, this is cool stuff from knot theory, the mathematical study of knots. Back in 1937, a mathematician named Wendt made a conjecture, an educated guess, about knot complexity.
How do you measure knot complexity?
One way is the unknotting number, the minimum number of times you have to pass one strand through another to completely untangle the knot. Wendt guessed that if you join two knots together, their complexities just add up. So if you join a knot that takes three moves to undo with another knot that takes three moves, the combined knot should take 3 + 3 + 6 moves. Seems logical, right?
Makes sense, but it's wrong.
It's wrong. Two mathematicians, Brittenham and Hermeller, found a counterexample. They joined a specific knot with an unknotting number of 3 to its own mirror image, which also has an unknotting number of 3. The resulting, more complicated-looking knot, it only took 5 moves to untangle, not 6.
Huh. So combining complexity doesn't always just add up.
Exactly. The way the knots are joined can actually create shortcuts, making the whole thing simpler, in a way, than the sum of its parts. It challenges some fundamental ideas about how knot complexity behaves. A really neat, kind of beautiful mathematical twist. Okay, on to our final major topic, and it's a really important one, the special report on Alzheimer's disease. It's obviously still a devastating diagnosis, but this report definitely highlights some real glimmers of hope. The focus is shifting towards a much broader strategy, prevention, new kinds of treatments, and crucially, earlier diagnosis. #tech#A, cultivating resilience, lifestyle interventions.
Right. The first big area of hope seems to be in things we can control, lifestyle changes, promoting what they call resilience. Big studies like Finger and Smart are showing that tackling known risk factors could cut the global rate of dementia by, what was that, a huge amount.
Up to 45%. That's massive potential. And these risk factors are things we know about. Diet, getting enough exercise, staying socially connected, managing blood pressure and cholesterol, even treating hearing and vision loss.
So addressing the whole picture of health.
Exactly. The SMART study was particularly striking. They gave people personalized advice on these factors, and that group showed a 74% greater improvement in cognitive scores compared to a control group just getting standard health info.
How does that work? How do lifestyle changes fight dementia?
The leading idea is that it boosts cognitive reserve. Think of it like building extra processing power or backup circuits in your brain. So even if some Alzheimer's pathology like plaques starts to build up, the brain has more capacity to work around the damage and maintain function for longer.
But we can't actually measure cognitive reserve directly, can we?
Not yet. That's the tricky part. There's no single biomarker for it. It's more of a concept right now. And we also need to be realistic. These lifestyle changes seem most effective for people in the early stages, like mild cognitive impairment. They don't appear to reverse full-blown dementia.
And there's a risk of people exploiting that hope, right? Selling unproven cures.
Oh, definitely. The article warns about this. You see companies pushing expensive supplements, extreme diets like keto, specialized brain training, often without strong evidence from rigorous trials. Desperate families can end up spending thousands over. The report mentions $3,000 a year for platform fees, $900 an hour for doctor visits on things that might not actually work. The hope gets commercialized way ahead of the science. #TechEpsobas. The treatment landscape. Amyloid and alternatives.
Okay, moving to drugs. For years, the big focus, the silver bullet approach, has been targeting amyloid plaques, right? Drugs like lecanemab, donanemab. They got FDA approval.
They did. And they do modestly slow down the rate of cognitive decline, statistically speaking, by clearing out some of those amyloid plaques thought to damage brain cells.
But there's a big but here, isn't there? The risks.
A very big but. First, these drugs are incredibly expensive. We're talking $26,000 to $32,000 a year, not counting the cost of the regular MRI scans you need while taking them. And second, the risk of side effects is substantial.
ARIA, amyloid-related imaging abnormalities.
Exactly. That means brain swelling or microbleeds.
Mm.
In some trials for donanemab, it affected over 30% of participants. And tragically, three deaths were linked directly to the drug in those trials.
Wow, 30% is high. That explains the skepticism from some doctors.
Yeah, many neurologists are still quite hesitant. They argue the benefit shown in trials is statistically significant, meaning you can measure a difference across a large group, but maybe not clinically meaningful for an individual patient's day-to-day life and quality of life, especially weighed against those risks.
And the risk gets worse if someone has a stroke while on these drugs.
That's a huge concern. Standard stroke treatment often involves blood thinners. If you're already prone to brain bleeds from the Alzheimer's drug, adding blood thinners could be catastrophic. Doctors worry these real-world risks are being underestimated compared to the controlled environment of a clinical trial.
So because amyloid drugs aren't a perfect cure and have these risks, the focus is shifting.
It has to. It's becoming clear that targeting amyloid alone isn't enough. Alzheimer's is complex, so the future is definitely moving towards a multi-pronged assault hitting the disease from different angles at once.
Like what kind of angles?
Things like tackling inflammation in the brain, maybe targeting TNF-alpha, improving how brain cells use energy, perhaps with intranasal insulin, strengthening the blood-brain barrier, the protective lining around the brain's blood vessels, and even exploring genetic approaches, like editing the APOE gene to boost the protective version.
Combination therapy, basically.
Almost certainly. Just like we treat many cancers or HIV now, using multiple drugs or strategies that attack different parts of the disease process. It's a recognition of the complexity we're dealing with. #C, diagnosis, care, and equity.
One really exciting area is earlier diagnosis, moving beyond expensive PET scans or spinal taps. Blood tests.
Yes, this could be a game changer. Several blood tests, like LumaPulse, are becoming available. They can detect key Alzheimer's biomarkers, like amyloid and phosphorylated tau, p-tau, much more cheaply and easily. For people already showing symptoms, the accuracy can be quite high, over 90%.
That makes diagnosis much more accessible. But are there equity issues?
Huge ones. This is critical. The report highlights a study where one blood test was 87% accurate at predicting amyloid plaques in white patients, but only 58% accurate in black patients.
58%, that's barely better than chance. Why such a difference?
We don't fully know yet. It underscores a massive historical problem. Decades of research have overwhelmingly focused on white populations, so the tests might not be properly validated or calibrated for other groups. It's a major gap that needs urgent attention.
And this ties into a broader crisis in dementia care, doesn't it? More people getting diagnosed as the population ages, but fewer places to care for them.
Exactly. Memory care facilities are actually closing in some areas. The burden is shifting more and more onto unpaid family caregivers, often spouses or adult children, who are stretched incredibly thin. The sheer economic cost is staggering, too. $781 billion annually in the U.S. alone.
And systemic racism plays a role here, too. Black Americans have double the risk.
They do. And research increasingly links this disparity to the cumulative impact of systemic racism.
Things like higher exposure to environmental pollution in redline neighborhoods, chronic stress from discrimination, less access to quality health care and healthy food options. These all take a toll on cardiovascular and brain health over a lifetime.
Are there efforts to tackle this systemically?
Yes. The report mentions initiatives like STARS State Alzheimer's Research Support Centers. The idea is to connect the dots between healthcare systems and social service agencies, like area agencies on aging.
Why connect them?
To track patient outcomes better and prove with data that providing social support services actually saves money. Things like delivering meals, helping with transportation, preventing falls. The hope is to show these services keep people healthier and out of expensive emergency rooms or long hospital stays. It's trying to make the economic case for better community care.
And finally, there's evidence that social factors can be protective, right? Even against biological risk.
Absolutely. Things like higher education levels and, really importantly, strong social connections. The report mentions the Sharp Walking Study in a tight-knit Black community in Portland. Even though participants might have higher biological markers for dementia risk due perhaps to lifetime stressors, the strong social fabric, the community support, seemed to act as a powerful buffer, protecting their cognitive function.
So community itself can be a form of medicine.
In a very real way, yes. It suggests that strengthening social bonds and community resources could be one of the most effective strategies we have in the fight against cognitive decline, especially in historically marginalized communities. #outtagoutro.
Wow. Okay, so this deep dive into Scientific American October 2025 really took us on a journey. From the sobering story of Breakthrough Starshot and the risks of relying on billionaire whims for giant leaps, to the intricate slow dance of ecology and decaying trees, and the ancient evolutionary pressures that drove bird migration.
Yeah, the sheer timescale differences are mind-bending.
And wrapping up with that complex multi-front war against Alzheimer's, realizing it's not just about finding a drug, but about lifestyle, care systems, equity. The whole picture.
It really covers the spectrum of science, doesn't it?
If you try and tie it all together, Starshot failing, the 200-year log study, the political inaction on landslides that are clearly getting worse, the decades-long progression of Alzheimer's, there seems to be a common thread running through almost everything we talked about.
What are you thinking?
It feels like it's all about timescales.
Yeah, I see that.
Recognizing these really long-term processes, whether it's wood decaying over centuries or a hillside slowly becoming unstable, or a disease developing over 30 years, these things require sustained focus, long-term thinking.
And that clashes directly with, well, pretty much everything about modern incentives, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Short-term profits, election cycles, news cycles, even the attention span of funders.
Exactly. Starshot fizzled because, arguably, the funders' focus was shorter than the project needed. Landslide policy fails because politicians and homeowners are thinking about the next few years, not the next few decades of climate change.
So the big challenge underlying all of this is figuring out how to structure science, policy, maybe even just our attention to match the actual timescale of the problems we face.
Yeah.
How do we plan and fund and maintain focus for the centuries, not just the next fiscal quarter or the duration of one person's enthusiasm?
That might be the biggest takeaway. How do we build that patience into the system?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question, isn't it?
Yep.
What stands out most to you from all that? We'll leave you, the listener, to chew on that.